You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by my fellow Washington National Tax Partners, Mark Price and Matt Mosby. We are all members of the Financial Institutions and Products Group at WNT. So welcome, Mark and Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Liz.
Yeah, great to be here.
And we are happy to have you here. So today we're going to talk about recently released proposed regulations on bad debt deductions. In general, these rules determine when a debt instrument becomes worthless for tax purposes. And as proposed, the rules set out a method of accounting where amounts that a taxpayer charges off from the allowance for credit losses on a financial statement would satisfy the requirements for a bad debt deduction under Section 166. The proposed regulations refer to this method of accounting as the allowance charge-off method, and it replaces the conformity method of accounting that a lot of banks currently use. So, very general overview, and there's a lot of nuances to unpack here. So, why don't we dive into that? And let's start just with a quick refresher on how banks claim a bad debt deduction.
Yeah, in general, all taxpayers are able to claim either a wholly worthless bad debt deduction or a partially worthless bad debt deduction in accordance with the rules under Section 166. You know, for all taxpayers, there's also a unique rule that would say if the taxpayer owns a security, and that's a security as defined under 165 G2C, so generally a debt that's issued by a corporation in registered form, then the bad debt rules don't apply to that taxpayer, but instead they're required to recognize a worthless securities deduction. So that's kind of the level setting for all taxpayers. But for banks, there's some unique rules. One, that rule that turns off bad debt and pushes you into the worthless securities rules is turned off for the bank. So just the taxpayer that is a bank and not subsidiaries within the group. And then two, there's two unique rules under the 166-2 regs that I think will probably, these rules will have the largest impact on. One, there's the conclusive presumption rule under 166-2D1. And what that rule says is, that if a regulator requires a loan to be charged off or the bank charges off a loan and the regulator comes in on the next exam and confirms in writing, then that debt's conclusively presumed to be worthless. The problem with that rule is that banks have a hard time getting that confirmation in writing. So I think for the most part, that rule has been very hard to apply. The rule that's probably more applicable is the conformity election under 166-2D3. And what that is an election that taxpayers can make that says, if they apply loan loss classification standards, then a debt is conclusively presumed to be worthless if it's charged off as a loss asset for the year. And that probably is more applicable to, this industry. One thing that's unique, or a couple things that are unique with that rule, is that one, it's a method of accounting, so you need to change to go on to it. And two, banks have been required to get an express determination letter, which is really a letter from the bank's regulators confirming that they do apply loan loss classification standards. So that's kind of the landscape prior to the release of the proposed regulations, Liz.
And I think that those express determination letters that conformity requires have also been difficult to get from the regulators. And in some instances, banks were unable to get that letter.
Yeah, that's right.
It does feel like these bad debt regs have been on Treasury's to-do list for a long time. Back in 2014, LB&I released a directive that attempted to fix some of the issues with bad debt deductions, including that issue with the express determination letter that applied to banks and some subsidiaries of banks. So we had this long time to-do list, the 2014 directive, and now the proposed regs currently. So why now? What changed that we got these today?
You might step back. 1 year before the directive, I think a notice came out from the IRS in 2013 asking for comments on changes that people felt needed to be made to the bad debt regulations, particularly the ones Matt just outlined that were specific to financial institutions based on the changes in accounting. There were changes early in the tens that raised some new and interesting questions. And then obviously later in the decade came the current expected credit loss model that also altered the financial accounting rules related to what we would call bad debt accounting. So I think with all of that going around, the directive was sort of a temporary fix. It wasn't precedential. It was only an agreement between by LB&I not to challenge certain positions taken by taxpayers, but it didn't have any greater effect. And in fact, I think they may have sunsetted sort of many years ago, and people were still relying on it informally, but maybe there's some outstanding discussion as to whether you really could rely on it. So guidance was needed to kind of deal with all the accounting changes, the practical changes that you and Matt have already mentioned about the express determination letter and everything else. I think that's what culminated in this project finally getting across the finish line after a little over probably 10 years of effort by Treasury and the IRS.
And I think the timing makes sense also from the standpoint that everyone is now on CECL, right? That accounting change has taken place. And I think there was a little bit of waiting for that as well, baked into what Treasury was doing.
Yeah, that may be the case. As your podcasts have demonstrated and a lot of other material demonstrates, there's a ton going on. It's sort of an unprecedented time where you've had major legislation. 2017, you had major legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, and Treasury and the IRS has to implement a whole bunch of new policies and principles. And getting bad debt to the top of the list is probably is both challenging and probably not the highest and best use of administration time when there are sort of more broadly applicable pieces of guidance that need to get out. And there's at least been an understanding, thanks to the directive, as to generally how to treat bad debt in the industry. So, I mean, some of it may just have been coincidental timing that this is a project that finally popped because they had a space in the calendar to get guidance out and people had time to review it.
That all makes sense. And it was a little bit of a surprise because I feel like, although it's been on the list, we've been waiting for a long time and kind of put it to the back of our minds. So let's dive into some more specifics on the proposed regs and what they do. It's this allowance charge-off method. Mark, do you want to take us through that?
On December 28th, the government published in the Federal Register these new allowance charge-off method regulations. They generally replace or would replace when finalized the two bank-specific rules, the so-called conclusive presumption and the conformity election rules that banks can currently avail themselves of instead of the standard method available to all taxpayers for bad debt. And what the rule generally provides is for this concept of an allowance charge-off method, which means that regulated financial companies and members of regulated financial groups are allowed to presume a debt is wholly or partially worthless when an amount is charged off from the allowance for loan loss on an applicable financial statement. So quick unpack there, you've got to have a charge off. It's got to be charge off from the allowance for loan loss, and all of that has to be reflected on an applicable financial statement. But if you check all those elements, then when that charge off from the allowance for loan loss occurs on the applicable financial statement, that amount is presumed to be worthless and a bad debt deduction to be allowed, sort of similar to the mechanics of the conformity election.
And it applies to regulated financial companies and members of the regulated financial group. So what entities are included in that definition, regulated financial group?
Yeah, so first, kind of unpacking the definition of regulated financial company, it obviously includes banks, but it includes a much larger population than just the banks. So it would include the bank's holding company. It would include, for example, an intermediate holding company. It also includes certain insurance companies. It includes Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So a much larger population than what we saw with the conformity election. In addition, it includes this concept called a regulated financial group, which looks at, you know, kind of an umbrella of entities with a regulated financial company sitting on the top. And to the extent that there's appropriate ownership of the subsidiaries, kind of looking at consolidated group principles, then those entities would also be covered by the ACM method. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that, you know, I discussed earlier this concept of worthless securities and bad debt deductions. That difference really only applies to the bank. So it does not apply to any subsidiaries or holding companies. So really, it's still only the bank that can turn off the 165 rule. One thing to also keep in mind are there are certain entities that will not be covered by the ACM method, and those exclude REITs and RICs. So REITs probably being the biggest one in this industry.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a lot of banks have captive REITs and need to take note that they're not included in this, although there's a comment period and potential for that being changed as these go final. So that's who this applies to. What is considered a charge-off under the proposed regs?
Proposed regs define a charge-off to be any accounting entry or set of entries that reduce the basis of the debt when the debt is, according to the regulation, recorded in whole or part as a loss asset on the applicable financial statement. So distilling that down, I think basically a charge-off is meant to be some accounting entry that actually reduces the carrying value of the asset on the balance sheet. There are a lot of journal entries that can be done, such as mark to market, that might create, when you take the entries apart, it might create some sort of entry that acts as a reserve or acts as an adjustment against the amount of the asset, so that when they're combined, it might show the asset at something other than its original cost or its historic cost. But when you take the entries apart, you see that they really haven't reduced the carrying value of the asset as a loss asset, or shown that the permanent value of the asset needs to be permanently reduced. Concept of the charge-off, though, kind of gets a little confusing in the regulations, because there's this notion of an involuntary charge-off as well. And that was a piece of an old regulation that allowed taxpayers to still meet the charge-off requirement when they didn't otherwise factually meet the requirements to take a tax deduction. And that rule just said that if they are taking a charge-off for GAAP purposes but aren't taking it for tax, then they can treat that charge-off as involuntary and will be deemed basically to have met the charge-off requirement in a later year. The proposed regulation somewhat adopts that, but it seems to adopt it in a way that is a little less clear. It just basically says when there is, if the taxpayer decides not to claim a deduction in the year of the charge-off, then the charge-off requirements deemed to have been met in any subsequent taxable year for which they claim a bad debt deduction. There's some clarification that needs to be made about that. But presumably that also kind of hinges off this charge-off concept. It just gives taxpayers the opportunity or the ability to defer deduction if for some reason they have to.
So it wouldn't allow for the acceleration, but potentially deferral of the deduction.
Yeah, potentially.
Let's talk about some of the major differences between current method, particularly conformity, and then the proposed method in the regs. I mean, we've already talked about there's no requirement for an express determination letter, which was one of the constraints under conformity. This is expanded in the proposed regs. It's expanding this method to certain non-bank entities, where conformity covered only the bank entity. What other differences should we be thinking about?
I think those are the two big ones, Liz, at least that I think that the IRS and Treasury intended to cover when they issued the proposed regulations. There are some additional items that I think people need to be thinking about that may make this slightly different than what they're used to under the conformity method. One is that there's this concept with respect to charge-offs needing to go through the allowance and the proposed regulations. And so as Mark had indicated, there may be some questions, at least in the proposed regs as drafted, if some of these accounting entries are reflected in earnings or somewhere else in the financial statements and may not allow a taxpayer to apply the proposed regulations or the ACM method, at least with respect to that loan. Another thing to keep in mind, at least with the proposed regulations, is that they include this concept of a loss asset being recorded for financial accounting purposes. I think that has raised some questions with respect to its applicability, because loss asset, I think most of us associate with the regulatory determination and not necessarily a financial accounting determination. Those maybe are two things to be thinking about with respect to the mechanics of financial accounting that at least you need to be considering as you're working through the potential adoption of these rules. One thing that people need to be thinking about when considering adopting the proposed regulations is with respect to non-accrual interest. And I think for a number of years, people have applied a revenue ruling 2007-32 that says if you're a conformity method bank, then you essentially get a deduction associated with any interest that's required to be accrued for tax purposes, but not financial accounting purposes. So net on your page one of your tax return, it nets out to zero. I think that there are some questions as to how that rule applies under the ACM. So that would be an area that would be helpful for the IRS and Treasury to comment on or to address in the final regulations. A couple of other things. One, that the preamble to the regulations make it pretty clear that they do not cover recoveries. So if you are calculating a book tax difference through a change in the allowance for loan loss on your financial statements, and there are recoveries going through that amount, that may require some additional analysis rather than just following financial accounting concepts. And then the last one is this concept or this difference between 166 bad debt deductions and 165 losses. So if you have subsidiaries that will be applying the ACM method, you still do need to go through the analysis to determine whether any of those subsidiaries hold 165 securities, and they're going to be scoped out here. So again, those are maybe some of the big things to think about as people are maybe digesting the proposed regs and thinking about applying them.
Yeah, those are all good call outs. And I think it speaks to the importance of modeling some of this out as you think about how this applies to your particular facts. I want to talk a little bit about transition as well. I think this is a change in a method of accounting for banks adopting this method, which will require a Form 3115. Currently, this is not listed as an automatic change. So it would be a non-automatic change, which of course needs to be filed before the end of the calendar year or tax year versus the automatic, which you have time to get in before the return is filed. So for purposes of 2023, it's too late to file a non-automatic change. However, that may be something that changes in the final regulations or perhaps with guidance coming out that would make this an automatic instead of non-automatic. Not sure there's current guidance as to whether it's a cutoff versus a 481A. Absent any specific language in the final regs, this would be a 481A adjustment. However, if we think about the conformity election and that method change, when banks adopt that, it really comes through as a catch-up method when they go on it. And then when they go off, it's a cutoff method if they leave conformity. So again, I think we may get some additional guidance on how this method change actually works. Let's chat for a minute. Is this mandatory? Do banks have to adopt this, Mark?
No, I don't think they do. I think it is something they can choose to adopt. The way the rules are written or seem to suggest that, as does the preamble.
Okay. And then considering early adoption, now we just talked about how currently we can't early adopt for 2023, but at some point, does it make sense for a bank to early adopt?
It could make sense. I think one note of caution about it right now is all of the items that you and Matt have raised about uncertainties about the new proposed regulation. And if you were to adopt it in its current form, you'd have to make some assumptions about how to handle those items. So that might be a reason not to. On the other hand, given the uncertain status of the directive and the effort it takes or the challenges people have had with respect to obtaining express determination letters, even if one's on or trying to follow a conformity-like method, it might be useful just to get the audit protection and certainty from adopting this proposed regulation prior to finalization. Or if you're not on those methods and you prefer to sort of move to that method now instead of waiting, that might also be a good reason to early adopt.
So any other transition issues we should consider, or what should banks be thinking about for next steps?
I think that there's a couple of things, Liz. I mean, one, people need to be digesting the regs and understanding the potential impact both on the bank and the larger regulated financial group. I think it would also be a good idea to coordinate with the group within the organization that's responsible for obtaining the express determination letter and make them aware of the rules and the changes, because this would presumably be a big change on what their process is in accordance with the regulatory exams. I think the other thing that people need to be keeping in mind or at least looking into is the accounting entries. I mean, there have been some significant changes for financial accounting purposes in connection with the adoption of CECL, as you guys had alluded to, and just making sure that those accounting entries align with the objectives in the ACM. So I think now it's kind of those are the two big things that I'm thinking about. And maybe the last thing that people need to be thinking about is just making sure that they're monitoring any comment letters and any additional guidance coming from the IRS, whether that's method change procedures or, you know, the release of final regs. With that, Liz, maybe I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Matt. And thank you both, Matt and Mark, for talking us through this topic today. A lot of good information, and look forward to having you back, and we can chat further either with final regs or additional notices and guidance that come out on this topic. And to our audience, thanks for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.